A little show note before we get started with the podcast. Dean Dillon, one of the greatest songwriters in country music. We love this guy. He is our songwriter spotlight that we're going to do this week. It's going to be at the end of this week's podcast, and you definitely want to stick around for that. It's awesome. If you love George Strait, you love Kenny Chesney, et cetera, you'll want to hear Dean Dillon on the show.
And now, the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
Big D and Bubba. They have a show five days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind, so they have an extra one, and that's how we get the podcast,
the podcast.
Big D and Bubba podcast, the podcast. Big D and Bubba podcast.
I don't let other people contradict what I do.
I think he meant to say control what he does.
That's good. I like it.
You know,
I don't let other people contradict what I do.
That was actually from this morning, wasn't it?
Yeah.
On the show.
Yeah, wasn't it great?
I love it. We can get golds in the wild like that.
Fresh gold.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go, kicking off the podcast. And if you don't know, it is sponsored by, this week, Castrol GTX Magnatec. And a lot can go wrong in 20 minutes. We all know that. We live our lives like that. Your car's engine is no different. Up to 75% of engine wear actually happens during warm-up. But Castrol GTX Magnatec has intelligent molecules that cling to your engine like a magnet, providing you instant protection from the moment you start.
What kind of hat are you wearing?
What kind of hat am I wearing? I don't even know.
Says,
HLB.
Oh, yeah, it's my high school hat.
Oh, yeah. HLB. What does that stand for?
Henry Louis Bourgeois.
Yes. H.L. Bourgeois.
H.L. Bourgeois.
Yeah.
The what were y'all?
The Braves. Number one reservation drive.
Wow.
Gray, Louisiana.
They still do that?
Yeah, man.
Wow, good for them. Keeping it going.
Yep.
All right.
Home of the Brave.
So today on the podcast, you know, we don't always have a guest. Sometimes it's just us. And we talk to ourselves. But today we do.
I like talking to ourselves. No offense. It's just fun talking to yourself with nobody answering.
But today, just a real treat. Rob Simbeck is joining
Woo!
Us.
Hey, hello, Rob. Guys. It smells really good in here. I got to get that out of my system.
What do you think it smells like?
It smells like these candles, whatever scent that is.
Wow, what a lame answer. Yeah. You could have
said. If you had a scent in your head and you said, "Man, this smells like,"
what do you think it smells like?
It's going to be cherry pie.
There's cherry in there. It's actually cherry tobacco.
Ah, okay.
Like pipe tobacco.
Yeah, cherry tobacco.
Somewhere, someone has made a pie out of tobacco.
Yeah, someone has.
By the way, kids, don't make a pie out of tobacco.
No, that's not good.
You'll puke.
So, Rob, aside from having a fabulous speaking voice and a bubbly personality, he is also, what all do you do?
I'm probably best known around Nashville for doing interviews for Bob Kingsley and writing part of his countdown.
So wait, he doesn't do his own interview? I always thought, like, because I grew up listening to Bob, he doesn't do them. I always thought he did his own thing.
He does some. He's in Texas. And so the Nashville interviews I do here. And he and I get to do them together during CRS, which is a blast.
Wow.
And he does some out there, but the bulk of them I do here.
Wow.
And how long have you been doing that?
I met him at CRS in 95, and I started working for him that September.
CRS is a big seminar for country radio, for those of you who don't know, probably most people don't know what it is. And it's a reason to get all the country stars and all the radio people together to party. I mean, I know they do some work during that week, but really, there's a lot of fun times.
The line was always that the hotel we used to have it at sold more booze the week of CRS than any other week in the year. I have no idea if that was true, but it sure sounds true.
Having been there for going on 15 years straight, that sounds about right.
So you started, you were writing bios for artists. Is that how you got into the business?
Well, no, I moved here as a songwriter from Los Angeles in 1982. I wrote at Combine, which had Larry Gatlin and Bob DePiro and Tony Joe White and John Scott Sherrill and just a ton of great people. That Looking for Love came out of there and two songs on Kenny Rogers' Greatest Hits. And I was a writer there starting in 82 and could never make a full living at it. And so I started looking for ways to get into freelance writing. I'd been a magazine editor in Los Angeles. I'd been a newspaper editor in Pennsylvania. And I started freelancing. One of the things I did was bios. I started at Warner Brothers. I went to every label in town, said, I used to be an editor. I know bios. Can I write them for you? And Janice Azrak, who was at Warner Brothers, hired me to do Billy Hill, which was John Scott Sherrill, Bob DePiro, and a couple other guys. And they liked that one. And the next four or five I did were Hank Jr., Emmylou Lou, Randy Travis, and Kenny Rogers.
So those bios for what? Like, where would somebody see those bios?
So whenever a new CD, at the time Records, goes out, the people in radio, the people with magazines and newspapers who get those CDs get a little three-page bio. Tells about the artist and about the project.
Their life story in three pages.
I've been looking at those things my whole life. I never stopped and thought, oh, yeah, somebody actually had to sit here and write this. Somebody had to come up with it. I guess you always just assume this is the artist's story, so they just sat down and told it to somebody. But
so that's kind of like the about me section on their website.
Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, these days, of course, the bios end up on the website as much as anywhere else.
And then on Wikipedia and all that.
Yeah, but they don't write them themselves. They tell their story to you, basically, and you write them. You still do a ton of those, right?
I do them now and then. I do Blake all the time. I just finished the one for his new record. And, I mean, but over the years, I've been really, really blessed with it. I did the very first Shania bio. I was once alone in a hotel room with Shania Twain, and it's because we were doing a bio interview. And the first Brooks and Dunn, and Waylon in the old days, and just it's been great. It's been really fun.
So what's the first thing that you? Because I thought it was an interesting question that you asked me. You asked me what my hometown is, and that's not a question that many people ask in the wild.
Yeah, where do you start? You write a bio of someone you never heard of.
It was someone you never heard of. I always start with what's the first thing you remember? And the second one is what's the first song that ever got through that little head of yours? Was it a lullaby? Was it something on the radio? Something in your parents' collection? And then we just go from there. And
you get people who answer and then regret answering the way they answered because then it gets tagged on them?
Not with a bio. And the trick is, I've often through the years done the bio interview in conjunction with a Kingsley interview. I do them both, and I always say at the beginning, look, with a bio, I need to know more than goes in there. So if you have been arrested or if there's something that we don't want in the bio, let's just talk around it. It comes out of the Bob interview, and it is part of – because the bio interview – I remember one time somebody who had been arrested had spent a year in prison. And
who was that?
It was.
Can we say now? I mean, is it cool?
I mean, it's public record.
It's public record. Yeah, it was.
Fact that you're struggling to remember tells me we're not going to know who it is.
No.
Are you trying to think of another name that make up?
No. I can picture him. It's one of those things. It will come back.
What's he
to
look
me.
Like? Tell us what he looks like. Describe him.
Close. Well, I can tell you this: that after he quit drugs. He gained a ton of weight, and so when he did, and he was on RCA, and when he did his audition in the office for Joe Galante, he wrapped himself from neck to waist in cellophane and had somebody tighten it up on him so he wouldn't look as big as he was, and he said, I was sitting there sweating like a pig playing for Galante, and Galante signed him.
Okay, who is this?
You gotta tell us who that is.
Greg Bates.
Greg Bates?
Hey, baby.
Is the Jeff Bates guy. No, that's Jeff Bates.
No, Jeff Bates is the Hey Baby
You're talking
guy.
Greg Bates.
No, maybe it was Jeff.
Oh, Jeff Bates was a while back. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a while back.
Was he on RCA?
Yes.
He got fat?
Yeah, because I remember meeting him. He wasn't fat. But
he was
maybe
kind,
he
wasn't
lost
he kind of ripped
then.
Or something like that back
that,
then?
That might not have been the same guy. We got to be careful here.
Did he have a goatee?
Well, I mean, that can come and come and go.
Yeah, we can look him up.
Aren't you glad you came today?
I sure am. I'm in trouble already.
Yeah, it didn't take long.
No.
Most people, it takes them 30 minutes or so. You did it. Here, show him this picture. Is this him? Is this what you're talking about? Is that the guy?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's
Jeff. Yeah, that's Jeff.
Jeff.
Yeah, and I think I knew he was in. You know, he always gave me kind of the...
good guy.
Yeah. I was going to say, he gives me the vibes that he was in prison before. I always had that kind of, like, you ever been around guys who've been, like, well, you have. But
just seem a little dangerous.
Have you been around more than him? Like, they have an edge to them. If you've been in prison, you have a little bit of a, like, and he hides it really well. Like, he has a kind of a, hey, how are you? But in reality, he's hardcore. He's had a tough life. And a lot of those guys who've been in prison, they have that kind of that edge to them. Well, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm just saying that's the way it is.
Like Johnny Cash?
Yeah.
I've done a couple of jailhouse interviews in the journalism part of my life. I was a reporter and editor at a newspaper in Pennsylvania. And there was a guy, I'll never forget, we had the same birthday. He turned 48 the day I turned 24. And I interviewed him. It wasn't in his cell. I think it was in his cell, actually. He had been part of five guys who had murdered somebody.
Jeez.
And I used to visit him in prison, and eventually he started asking for things, and he wanted to do his life story. He wanted a typewriter. He wanted paper. He wanted money and stuff. And finally, I said, I can't do this anymore. And he said, when I get out, I'm going to kill the guy who first pulled the trigger on this guy that we killed, and then I'm going to kill you.
What?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And when the Music Row murder happened with the guy from Cashbox who wouldn't take part in the fixing of the charts,
yeah,
interviewed the guy who pulled the trigger.
Okay, we weren't here then. Tell us that story.
That was 89. Well, I think it was 89.
Because I've only heard bits and pieces of that. So set that up for us a little bit.
So one morning, the word goes around that there's been a guy who was killed on Music Row. And he was a kid. He was 21 years old. He was fresh out of Belmont.
And Music Row is basically, for those who don't know, again, I think we should get, it's a bunch of houses that have been converted into recording studios, and next door might be an office building or whatever, but it's just nothing but music industry and lawyers.
Yes, and it was started back in the 40s, the first studio at the Quonset Hut. It gradually built up to be where the industry was, and right now it's all going to condos because there's not much money in publishing anymore. And It's where the music business happened, and so there was word got around that a young guy was killed on the street there, and at first it went around that it was probably a robbery gone bad, and gradually it came to be that Cashbox magazine at the time had somebody working for them who was cooking the charts, and
like
paid extra money and took out ads and things and could get a good spot on their chart, and this guy, whose name was Kevin Hughes, found out about it, and they figured he was honest and straight enough that he was probably going to
rat him out,
either approach the cops or something, and so they killed him. And so it was 15 years later before they finally caught the guy who did it, and he was dealing cards in Vegas, and they arrested him and brought him back. And I jumped on the story for the scene and interviewed him and just let him tell his story, tried to get him to admit, you know, what he had done and what had happened, and he didn't. And when I came back the second time and said, I don't believe a word that you're telling me, he, at that point, didn't talk to me anymore. And the story led to, I've done the Investigation Discovery Network. They have a show, I forget which one it is. But it's how people meet the people who end up killing them. And I was a talking head on that.
Wow.
So going back to the guy that you had the same birthday with.
Yes.
Did he ever get out of prison?
I don't think so, but he was 48, and this was in 1975. So I think he's long since dead. I think.
Did that keep you up a lot?
No, it's it could make me a little nervous here and there, but I knew he was in prison, and I wasn't too worried about it. And the interesting thing was the guy who actually planned the thing and put the first bullet in it, and then in the guy, and then passed the gun around. He got out. He was acquitted. The rest either went state's evidence or went to prison.
Wow.
Being a reporter,
should there be a documentary about this? I mean, it sounds like one of those things that we would watch on Netflix. You know, like I've watched the one about the nun. I've watched a bunch of, like, what's the one with your little guy, the car?
Making a Murderer.
Yeah, Making a Murderer. It sounds kind of like that kind of a show.
Yeah, there are so many. I mean, the number of murders and interesting murders is why there are so many shows on the Investigation Discovery. Yeah. Now, we're going to used to be the pulp magazines that used to do this back in the 40s and 50s, the true crime magazines, stuff like that. And now it's on
television. Yeah.
But there are so many like this.
I mean, I remember reading a Stephen King book when I was like 12 and saying, oh, that was kind of scary. My father going, here, you want to read something really scary? And he pulled a book off the shelf and handed it to me. It was Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi, who was the DA who tried Charles Manson. And this was his, this was the book about the Manson murders. And I read that, and yeah, that's it. I'm good. I never have to watch another scary movie or anything ever again.
I never
the scariest thing I've ever heard. Oh, my goodness.
Now,
yes.
Manson, now that Manson's dead, more came out about it. But I guess I just never realized that he never actually killed anyone.
He just
told
other people
to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's actually more evil, if you think about it. Convincing someone else to kill someone and they do it is probably more evil than doing it yourself, because you're ruining two people. You're killing this person and you're ruining the life of the person you convinced to do it.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's.
And there are lots of organizations like that, from drug organizations mm-hmm. to gangs to the original mob, where there were people directing traffic from someplace fairly safe.
Like jail.
Sometimes
like jail, yeah.
Wow.
Have we gotten off the topic?
Yeah, no kidding. So back to
You're in the hotel room with Shania. And so when you're writing these bios, that kind of leads you into making connections with the artists and labels and their management and all kinds of stuff. And so then you must have, when you do interviews, they've got to be very knowledgeable, because you know everybody.
Are you saying that I go in prepared. I try to be the most prepared person they deal with. I mean, it's so much.
I have been at I don't know what you call this. They have these summits or these things where multiple people will interview one artist. Like Dierks Bentley, we went to Panama City and there were about six different people there to interview Dierks Bentley. And we ran that interview on the show. And I've been at several of these things where Rob is there and he is the, not, it's not even close, because the other people are me, and I'm not anywhere near as prepared.
But I will say this, Rob, you go in and you do these interviews and they're really well prepared, but I would say that there's also something to, because
an interview like you would.
We don't do them that way, and we never have. And I'm sure there are things that we miss. Like, I'm sure in research you find out something that is interesting that we would want to bring up. But I find that if we ever do it like that,
we're not good at that.
We don't do it well.
But yeah. There's different kind of interviews. The trick is that what we're doing here is having an interesting conversation, period. It could lead anywhere. And you guys are sharp and intuitive enough to follow rabbit trails, to go places, to keep it interesting. You just know what makes the conversation. If I do an interview for a bio, I'm simply gathering as much data and as many good quotes as I can to present somebody well, you know, whether it's Blake or somebody brand new. And when I do them for Bob, I'm looking for 30 to 60-second
sound bites.
Oh. I'm looking for them.
And so you don't need the interview to flow well from start to finish.
Instead of being a conversation, you're just looking for the things that you can isolate and go, boom, here's your power piece. Go for it.
I may just say, where you met your wife. You know, it has nothing to do with me sounding good or intelligent or anything else. It's knowing what story they might have in them and just triggering it. And then sitting back, don't laugh, don't cough, don't do anything else. Let them tell the story and shut up.
Do you find, who was it a long time ago that said, when you're doing the interview, sometimes the best thing to do is just shut up. You know, let somebody else talk.
Here's my favorite one. I was, it was CRS 1 year, and Big Kenny and I were walking across the suite. I had a studio set up in the suite. And I asked him a question about leaving Warner Brothers. And he was carrying a guitar. And we sat down at our seats opposite each other, and I turned on the microphone, and for the next 30 minutes, I never said a word. Never.
I believe he just talked.
He sang two songs in the middle of it. I knew it was all perfect, and I just sat there and watched him.
Brother, let me tell you.
Oh, I can hear it now, man.
Absolutely.
Brother.
Oh.
When's the last time you planted anything?
You know.
But we still make fun of him. If you don't know, he sends CDs out. And the cardboard case the CDs came in was actually like it had seeds
and
in it.
You say we made fun of it, but
plant
it was
in the ground.
It was ingenious.
The man's
it was
brilliant.
Weird. Yes, we make fun of that. It was weird.
I thought it was pretty smart.
But we didn't plant it.
I did.
Of course you did.
It's in Stacy's little garden in the backyard.
Is it still there?
Yeah. I don't know what kind of plant, because she has all kinds of different little plants in there.
It probably wouldn't be great if you just grew up and it turns out it's a marijuana plant. That'd be great. Wouldn't that just be great? That'd
be
so
funny.
Kenny, right? Did you plant that? I did. Oh.
Ooh, don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody.
You did it in the woods,
right? You still living where you were? Yeah, so it's completely different. I think interviews are interesting. I don't even like the word interview because conversations. Yeah, because I hear a lot of radio people, they get artists and they go into stuff that like I wouldn't want to. I don't care about hearing. And I think that's kind of, well, I don't think that is what we do. We do things only what we think would be interesting. And like I said, we do miss some stuff.
We used to catch flack for it. I'm not going to say who.
All the time.
But you know, like I remember somebody turned us down. There was a big star on a big label who one time was offered to come on the show. And it never even got to their ears because their record label person said, "I don't want to hear, you know, what kind of I don't want to hear Big shampoo. D and Bubba asking what kind of shampoo this person uses."
But it was, you know? But it made sense for this person, and it was interesting.
It was someone else you had asked that question to, and it made sense, and you know.
Anyway, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the point
is: have you ever done an interview that then ran, and then someone got mad about the interview afterwards, or you pretty much managed to stay away from that?
I don't recall anything, and I remember Tanya giving us such good quotes that we thought surely somebody's going to call from the label, and they didn't.
She's when she came in, I'll never forget. It's when she was doing that TV show.
It's over 10 years ago now.
She came in.
Tuckerville, whatever.
And she came in, and everybody else came in first. So you had all the camera guys. They came in. They set up lights, and they're going to use it in part of the one of the episodes, the interview that we're doing with her. And then I'd never met her, and so she walks in, and she's like, "Hey, darling," or "Hey, love," or "Sugar girl," or whatever. I forget what you call it, but I'll never forget how low of a cut of a dress she had on. It was like down to
here. She wanted to look good
here,
on TV, man.
And she had glitter all over her boobs. They were everywhere. And she hugged me, and it just transferred. You mean like silly putty?
Silly putty to
on a newspaper. And then I had it on me, and
then you had to go home and explain that.
Why do you have glitter? Someone other woman's boob glitter on you?
It was everywhere. And
you don't remember anything else about that interview, do you?
Oh yeah, no, yeah, I do. I also remember she had a guitar player who had. Sunglasses. Now you see how dark our studio is now. Okay, it was really dark.
We actually turn the lights up whenever we do the podcast so we can get some of the stuff on camera. As you saw when you first came, it was much darker in here.
So this guy's
it's a cave.
Yeah, he's wearing sunglasses, and I was like, I think it's so cool that you have a blind guitarist. And she was like, What do you mean? And then he took him off, and I was like, put him back on, please. I know why you have them on now. What are you doing?
I don't even get that.
What?
I don't even get that. Like, why did he take them off?
Why did he take them off?
Yeah.
Because we made fun of him for wearing them.
I know, but I'm saying, never mind.
Because they're all bloodshot, because he's doing drugs. But he wasn't. I was just checking.
Oh, gotcha.
When you do interviews, so you can make a living just doing interviews for Kingsley?
I can, but I also...
Dang, are you serious?
But, yeah.
We work too hard.
Listen, that's the biggest radio show. That's one of the biggest radio shows in the world. It's on over 350 stations.
I know, how much time does it take out of your week?
To do everything for Bob?
Yes. Everything that you get paid for.
Well, the trick is, My life is that show. I write books. I average about a book a year.
Okay, so you're doing other
magazine
things.
Articles.
And everything's kind of all blended together.
Everything.
Okay, well, that kind of feeds
back and forth.
Yeah.
So, like, and that's the thing, too, just like with Patrick, because Patrick is kind of like our show partier. He is our surrogate, you know, for, like, the parties and things like that and the events. Patrick goes to all of the cool things. But that kind of stuff is the stuff that you do as well. But it's also part of your job. Your job and your life are really weirdly intertwined.
Yeah. I grew up as a fan of music, and I'm in Nashville, and I hang out in the music world.
How did you two meet?
You and Patrick?
At some party or some event.
You know what? I think we had our first conversation of all the weird places that I know. Rob is one of those guys, probably like me with my big beard, and you see he's recognizable. I see him, and I go, I know that guy, but I never talked to him. I sat next to him at a concert, a private concert with Jake Shimabukuro.
Oh, wow.
The ukulele player.
At BMI.
Ukulele. I was playing at BMI, which is the big one of the big music royalty companies here in town. And it was weird. It was just this very odd, like, this isn't country music. There's not even any words. It's this guy playing the ukulele, and we'd had him on the show before.
And he is amazing.
It's just somebody sitting next to me, knew Rob, and then we start talking. And then next time you see each other, it's like, no, I know that guy.
Then we ended up in
Panama City at that Dierks Bentley interview. Yeah. And, you know.
And befriended
Rob
one another.
I'm going to go ahead and say this. So Rob is sober. And
right now?
Right now, but all the time. And when was the last time you had a drink? Probably
April 4th, 1987.
Wow. So 30 years. And so we're always around these things. And one of the primary, you know, functions of these things is that everyone's drinking.
Well, I mean, what's your nickname? Rob, what's your nickname, Patrick?
My nickname is Five Whiskey Patrick. That is what they call me. That's not really my nickname. That is
I didn't even know Five Whiskey Patrick.
That's an alter ego
Five
of mine.
Five Whiskey Patrick is a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Is there a Twitter? Is there a
Hashtag
Five Whiskey Patrick?
Five Whiskey Patrick. There's about to be. It's like my alter ego. After I have about five drinks, I don't care anymore, and I'll say whatever. And that's like the perfect level, because after that, then I'll say at five whiskeys, I still know sort of what not to say. And at eight whiskeys, it's like, you think she knows that dress makes her ass look big? You know, I was like, oh, no.
So just five Whiskey Patrick and six Whiskey Patrick, are they like arch enemies?
I mean, five Whiskey Patrick is just right. 8, 9, 10 is where things get really out of hand.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
8, 9, 10 is where I'm at the Kenny Chesney concert going, who are all these people and why are we here?
Rob, have you had to put him in check? Have you had to go like, Patrick?
No.
Patrick, let's talk.
No, maybe in Panama
City. Rob, you could be his sponsor.
I've never had
a sponsor.
Is this secretly an intervention and I didn't know it?
Patrick, you scheduled
your own intervention.
Yeah. What I meant to say was that Rob is always there, kind of extremely sober and watching, and he has this kind of mind anyway, where he's always making notes of things and you know, an interviewer and a writer. So I feel like Rob knows more about all of us than we know about him.
Yeah, he's like that guy that just sits back and writes.
He's got a little notebook and he's going, going to remember that for maybe later.
Yeah, watch out for those guys.
I did have a nickname in the old days, and it was 10 to 10 at Frugal McDougal's. They called me 10 to 10 because that's when I went in every night.
Did they close at 10?
Yes.
I like 10 to 10. That's a good nickname.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Five Whiskey Patrick's pretty strong, though.
It is. I'm going to start on
my own
podcast.
Have I ever seen Five Whiskey Patrick?
Oh, yeah.
I have?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. It's not something that happens often, but I know.
Like, you probably saw him at his birthday party that time you went.
Where's Carson?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Oh, hey, I did see exactly right. But it wasn't Five Whiskey Patrick at your birthday party I walked in on. Yeah, so Patrick has a big birthday, Pat. He has a big birthday thing every year. Yeah, I don't know if people have birthdays every single year.
Hi, Carson.
And
hi.
So he has this big party, and he wants me to go, and he invites me, and he does the BS way of inviting me through Facebook, which is lame.
Everyone does it now.
And I'm like, okay. I finally tell my wife, I go, you know what? Let's go to Patrick's party. He's having a big party at his house. Let's just go. He never thinks that we're going to show up.
It's going to blow his mind.
So
it did. I was quite blown away. That was, what, two years ago?
Yeah, we drove 14 days to get to his house and pull up, and there's cars everywhere. It looks like a frat party.
Yeah.
And, I, you know, it's one of those things, you don't knock on the door because it's just already open, and, you know, I kind of walk on in, and I don't know anyone. I'm like, hey, where's Patrick? I don't know. I think he's out there. So went in to finally find him. He's in the kitchen. He turns around and he's like, hey. And then I was like, what is going on?
I think I had a unicorn head.
You had a unicorn head on.
It was like, and you guys were drinking. A pinata that had
they were drinking like some sort of a red punch thing.
Out of an ice chest?
Out of a big giant. I thought y'all had it in a big pot.
We have it in a gumbo pot.
Yes. Big gumbo pot. And they've been making it, I guess, all day or something, or I don't know.
Letting it fester.
And I was like, Kathy, just don't touch anything. Let's just get in here and say, give him the gift and let's leave.
Yeah, I noticed you didn't stay long.
Oh, no, I totally deed you.
D said, asked Carson if he'd ever met Five Whiskey Patrick. And I was like, I don't know. Carson probably has a few Five Whiskey Patrick stories.
I think I met Five Whiskey Patrick. I hadn't even started. Yet, and Patrick invited me over to his house to watch
started
football.
Working with
I hadn't started working yet, and he started me. He had me over his house
New Year's Day,
on New Year's
right?
Day to watch football, and it's very awkward because we only ever talked on the phone. So I walk in there, and everybody's kind of half out of it because it's New Year's Day. But I guess you just keep rallying and drinking.
Yeah, you
and
do.
Meanwhile, this is my boss, so I'm dressed kind of nice. Hello. How are you? Do you need me to bring anything? And he actually gave me a grocery list of things that I could bring to his house.
Good for you.
Can you go? There's a store.
Listen.
Oh, can you pick up
before
these
you show up? We did.
It really was. Like, I think it wasn't just, oh, you know, we ran out of a mixer or something. I was tasked to bring specific snacks.
Hey, heck yeah.
Like, so, and so I walked in. I'm like, hello. How are you? Hey! All right, that's Patrick. That is Five Whiskey Patrick.
Has he broken that, like, since then? Has he kind of, because that was your first real impression.
Yes.
Or has it kind of stayed the same?
Oh, it's the same. Absolutely.
Your impression of me hasn't changed since the first minute of day one?
Not at all.
Good.
Rob, what made you go sober?
The kind of troubles that make people go sober. Car wrecks, hospitals.
Unicorn heads.
Unicorn heads, yeah.
And so finally you said, okay, I got it.
This isn't going to work anymore. This is not going
to
work.
Was that a decision that you made or someone came to you and said, okay, listen, Rob, you got to.
No, it was pretty much mine. It was, people knew that I was in trouble with it and had been for a while. I was living in a rented room in East Nashville, no curtains, no furniture. That'll tell you something.
Wow.
Wow.
And I was 34 when it happened. Been sober since.
How long does it take you to, when that day starts, you're like, okay, I'm done. Are you one of those who can go, okay, I'm done, and you just don't, it doesn't bother you?
I sweated bullets for a while. It was really probably 2 years before I didn't feel like I really, you know, was out of temptation's way.
Man, I would think it would be really hard because of what you do in these parties. You know, we talked about it earlier about going to these parties, and there's just so much alcohol at the parties and so many things going on. I would think it'd be really difficult to stay sober.
Well, I gave up, and this is not, I'm not comparing it to that, but I gave up carbs 8 months ago.
Very different.
Hold on. There's a point to this. Okay. And you go to these parties, and there's food, and it's there, and it's all the time. And they also have liquor, and I drink the liquor. And someone said to me once, what's the best part about your job? And I said, the best part about my job is probably free whiskey. And the worst part about my job is definitely free whiskey. It's one of those things. It's like, I can handle alcohol. I haven't had a drink in 3-4 days. I don't drink. We go out to dinner. I don't drink. I don't go home and drink. But if I go to a party and there's free liquor, I don't know. Something about free liquor says.
That's like your bat signal.
That's it. Hey, you got to drink the free whiskey.
Five Whiskey Patrick, where are you?
There is also something, and I don't know if you find
it. Five Whiskey Patrick.
I have basically stopped drinking. Occasionally I'll have like a glass of champagne, but I struggled with way too much alcohol in my younger years. So we go to these parties and I'm always the one, hi, I love a Diet Coke. And what do? They pour it and then they put the straw in it. So I walk around looking like a 4-year-old. You know, it's
what you need to do is get a Diet Coke with an olive in it. And then they'll be like,
about the first grossest of all, thing
disgusting.
I've ever heard.
Well, no, you don't know if it's disgusting. Have you ever tried it? No. See? Get a Diet Coke with an olive in it, and then everybody will think it's a mixed drink, and have that little sword or the little umbrella,
sword.
You know, and you'd be good.
Yeah, that's just what I find from a, not peer pressure, but something that I freak out that people might notice.
And that's the thing, is you don't figure out until you get on the other side and have been there for a while that most people at these parties aren't drinking, and those that are drinking, most of them aren't drinking problematically. I was.
Yeah.
And I always assumed everybody else was. And it was an erroneous assumption. It just took a while to learn that after I was newspaper business from my earliest days. We got off at 1 o'clock in the morning in Pennsylvania. The bars closed at 2. And so when I walked into our bar, the guy knew to put up 4 shots of peppermint schnapps and 4 beers at my chair,
goodness.
At my stool. And that would get me started. That would get me started.
Wow. Patrick, tell him how when you gave up deodorant.
Hence
See,
the candles.
I said before I made the statement that it wasn't the same thing, but I was on a.
I too have given up carbs.
First of all, you have not.
No, I have not. Carbs are great.
I ate a 1-pound Nestle bar the other day.
Bubba, so we had these. Someone sent 4 pounds of chocolate to us.
It was
in
the best.
In the amount of. 4 1-pound, a 1-pound Snickers, a 1-pound Nestle Crunch, and all this stuff.
Yep.
First of all, Bubba ate a whole one here the day they showed up.
Well, I
and
ate
then
half of one.
I never even
half
saw the
one.
Nestle Crunch.
Yeah, because I requisitioned it.
Then the other three sat on the table in the kitchen
until
in the green
yesterday.
Room. Nobody was eating them, and Bubba goes, "Well, if nobody's going to eat them, I'm going to take them home." Like, wait, no. That's
did you take them home?
Yes,
I did.
He did.
I did.
And so you can be away by yourself
and
in
eat
a room.
4 pounds of chocolate.
No.
When he told me the other day he was back on the wagon.
I am on the wagon.
Oh, yeah.
What wagon is he on?
He's on the chuck wagon.
He's on the chuck wagon. That's it.
I will send you a picture of them. I haven't eaten them yet. They will be eaten.
Yeah, that Snickers, it says on the directions to slice it. It's like a loaf.
It's a loaf.
It is a loaf of Snickers.
Loaf a Snicker loaf.
Oh, no. It looks like one of the Snickers is the size of my forearm. I'm not kidding. It's huge.
It is. It looks like one of those things that truckers carry to beat people over the head with. It really is. It's dangerous.
It's a cricket bat.
But we're gonna tell Bubba. Okay, right now. Send us a picture of that candy on your counter right now that you haven't eaten. We're going to get it back, and it's going to be, like, obviously Photoshopped, you know,
fluffed up.
You'll be like, the lighting isn't even right.
I might be stopping at the store to pick some up before I go home so I can have them, like, there.
What else? What else do you struggle with? Do you have any kind of other, addictions or
yeah,
anything?
This isn't weird. Let's make it weirder. You got any? You ever done heroin, Rob? No, don't answer that.
At the age of 16, I was in a game of Guts,
what is that?
It's two card poker, where you have two cards and you make the best poker hand out of it. And if you don't win that hand, you double the pot. And at $32, at the age of 16, I swore off gambling forever. That's the other
$32 did it for you.
$32. It was a cheap and easy lesson compared to some of the stuff.
I wish someone
taught
me that lesson.
But, you know,
16.
I've always felt the same way because, like, we do a lot of casino events and things like that, and I don't gamble. And if I do, I'll take $20 out and I'll go, okay, this is $20 I'm going to spend for entertainment. I don't even think that I'm going to spend it to win. I say this is I'm going to entertain myself for 5, 10. Minutes, maybe 15. If I'm really lucky, I get an hour out of this and it's all good.
Yeah.
And we've tried doing things where we make bets on the show, but I always look at it like this. If there's something that I'm willing to bet, that means I'm willing to lose it. Therefore, I don't care about it. So I've already lost.
So you don't drink, you don't gamble.
What do you do?
Yeah.
What? I mean,
music.
Are you legitimately an Adam Ant song right now?
Music, writing, and my better half, Debbie. Pretty much occupy my time.
Oh, wow.
That's nice.
Yeah. You're relaxed. Speaking of gambling with Debbie, we went to Vegas one time, and she said, I want to go do the slots. I said, great. And she said at one point, I want to cash out. I'm $14.35 up. That's my kind of girl. Yeah, and so we cast out, and we're walking out the door. And she said, I can't believe we came out ahead. And I said, Debbie, the monorail ride over here cost $20. We did not come out ahead.
Well, bless
her. I had a buddy that used to, like, try to gamble to pay his rent. I'm like, dude, you can't do that, man. It's not going to work.
How long have you and Debbie been married?
We've been together since 1989.
Almost 30 years.
So she, you met her a year and a half to 2 years after you got sober.
I actually met her before I got sober. She knew me the last 2 years of my drink, and she was dating my roommate.
Okay.
And then they broke up.
Wait, the roommate with the no curtains furniture?
Yes, I rented a room from a guy who had a house.
Okay,
and
okay.
And he was dating her. And then they broke up, and about 2 years later, we went out. I was 3 months sober, and I was still pretty much, you know.
Antsy?
The first date was baseball game at Greer Stadium, and they had fireworks afterwards, and I thought I was going to die. My nerve endings were just shattered.
Wow, and really?
Oh, yeah, it was rough.
So, okay, so this is way more serious than I thought. So you were in really, really bad shape.
I nearly died, yes.
So it had to take you years just to get healthy, like normal?
It was.
You said it was 2 years, right?
2 years until I felt like I was pretty much coming around. And the trick was I had all this extra time where the drunks and the hangovers used to go. I started walking around the block. I lived in East Nashville. Started walking around the block. And eventually I started jogging. And one day I timed myself and I ended up running the Boston Marathon.
That is awesome.
I got addicted to running. And,
I wish I could get addicted to something like that, something healthy. I got addicted to eating broccoli or just something, you know.
Nobody ever gets addicted to broccoli.
Nobody ever does. Okay, somewhere is addicted to broccoli.
Somewhere.
When you finished your first marathon, okay, go back. Was Boston your first one?
No, it was second. You got to qualify for it. The first one was in Huntsville.
You finished the one in Huntsville, your very first one. Yep. You cross the finish line. And you're sitting there probably breathing heavy or whatnot.
Oh, I was getting ice on my legs. I was in the medical. It was at the Hilton Hotel down there was the headquarters for it. And so I'm lying there with somebody putting ice on my legs.
And
I felt wonderful. I hurt. Wow. My legs were like toothaches. There's a toothache from the waist down on both sides. Oh, and I felt better than I had ever felt.
Did you at that time stop and have a moment? Did you have a Rob moment where you were like, look where I've come?
I get those a lot. Every day's a gift. I pretty much almost threw away my life. And for me to, you know, to have a few bucks in the bank, to work with Bob Kingsley, to get to hang with great people in Nashville, and to have a semblance of a real life, I, you know, look at as miraculous every day. And I wrote a piece about that for the Nashville Scene at the time. I wrote a piece called Running It Off, where I compared being an alcoholic to being a marathon runner. Because if you're one or the other, you're beating your body to shreds every day, and yet you do it. Everybody else doesn't get it. They're like earthlings. You know, if you're running marathons or if you're a real drinker.
No, I get it.
Nobody else. And there's just all these parallels. And so I did a piece about that and then one about running Boston.
So are you kind of an extreme kind of person? Like, do you find
I got no middle gears. It's off or it's fifth gear. That's
sound like anybody you know?
It sounds like fifth whiskey Patrick.
There's a lot of us out there. There's a lot of us out there.
I mean, maybe Patrick will be running marathons in a few years.
Let's go with no.
Patrick, I want you to spend as much time as you can with Rob.
Yeah.
Whatever he does, you do.
Jeez. Have you ever known? I mean, most creative people that I know have gears that don't mesh up with everybody else's. The most interesting people at most parties are the creative types, and most of them have a glitch somewhere, something that's just off plumb a little bit.
A glitch. A glitch is a great word.
And, you know, it's a good thing. It's a matter of, you know, at some point you find out how to make all that work as a life and a career.
I know a lot of comedians, and they're all messed up. They're all weird.
Comedians for
all
sure.
All the best ones for sure.
Absolutely. And I mean, yep. I try to, I wish I was a comedian. If, you know, if I could snap my fingers and have any job, that's what I would want to do. But it's like,
you are a comedian.
I don't know. I am, yeah. And I've done it, and I've done stand up, and
you're
good. You know, and I try to be the guy who tells jokes occasionally.
I've tried to tell Patrick to leave the show. Remember, I said, dude,
don't tell him that.
Well, I didn't say
I don't want to do that.
No, but I'm saying you're. I think you're missing
Bubba's trying to get rid of me.
No, I think you're missing an opportunity.
Talks about it all the time.
I think you're missing an opportunity. I think you're really good.
He is frequently the most interesting conversationalist in a given room.
He's a very funny guy. So, and this is
that means a lot.
This is a love letter to you, Patrick, from me. I think you're very talented, and I think you should at least on weekends. I'm not saying leave us for good. I'm saying at least on weekends, try to go and do some shows. It's worth it. You're good.
I don't know. That's not where I was going with this, but what I was going to say is that comes from being an unusual person. It comes from being your brain doesn't work like quote unquote normal people. And there's a lot of good that comes with that. And then there's occasionally a little bad that comes with that. You know, I don't know how to talk to people who
like
I don't know.
Like having a nickname called Five Whiskey Patrick.
Like that, you know.
You don't know how to talk to people you
don't
know.
I don't talk to people I don't know. I don't. If you've ever been in a Carson and Rob have both been in a lot of rooms with me where events are going on. We did that thing with Lauren Elena, the video about me talking to girls.
Mm-hmm.
My sister-in-law, who's known me since I was 11 years old, got really upset. And I saw her, you know, the next family holiday or whatever. And she said, that was made up. I said, no, it's not. That's exactly how I am. She goes, that's not you at all. You'll talk to anybody. I said, no, I'll talk to anybody if they talk to me. So you've never seen me. The trick of being someone who doesn't talk to strangers is there's always enough people in a room that I know that I can go talk to, or other people will come up.
Those people
will introduce me to people. I have this intense fear of going up to someone I don't know and starting a conversation.
I get that.
I won't
Big
do
D
it.
Is probably the best of walking up to somebody he doesn't know, that he's never met, has nothing in common with, and just striking up a conversation. You do it better than anybody I know.
Yeah. I'm almost paralyzed by fear. Like I can't, I can't do it. If I'm in a room and I don't know anybody and nobody shows, just comes up and strikes up a conversation, I'll just stand there. Now, you guys might all think it's crazy that I would stand quietly in a room full of people, but I'll do it if no one talks to me and I don't know anyone.
Hmm.
So it's just a weird thing. So I don't know.
Does Five Whiskey Patrick do that?
Usually, I don't know. I don't usually have five whiskeys if I'm standing in a room and I don't know anybody. I don't stick around long enough.
Oh, interesting.
So, usually Five Whiskey Patrick comes out because it's a party and we're having too much fun.
Yeah.
A little too much.
A little too much.
By the way, I do want to make a quick show comment. This morning we had the guy who plays Jesus on the show from The Walking Dead,
Tom Payne.
And people are mad at us because we have a history of Walking Dead characters coming on our show and dying shortly thereafter on the show. And they're really upset with us right now because, you know, he's a very popular character. We're sorry. I swear we didn't mean to have him on the show. If something happens to him this week, just saying, it's not us.
But he'll be back in 3 days. God, my mom.
Oh, wow.
Snare drum.
It
doesn't even
take a second.
It doesn't even take that long. Oh,
man.
I thought you meant turning like into a zombie.
Oh,
now I get what you mean.
Come on, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was
thinking Walking Dead.
We haven't killed off, what's the other one?
Eugene.
Eugene's on
alive.
And he was fine.
He's been on several times, yeah.
I think it was because everybody you've talked to since I've been here, which would be Eugene and Jesus, but
so
they're
maybe
not dead.
Carson's yeah, maybe so I turned fixed it around. It.
Did we break the, was yeah, the first
Eugene
one to do it was Sasha.
Well,
Sasha stayed on a full season.
They were only setting up interviews with people. And they were trying to get that last little bit of publicity out of him before they killed him off. So that's how I see it, is they would say, hey, you want to talk to someone from The Walking Dead? How about this girl? And we'd be like, yeah. And they were making her do interviews while she still worked for him because they were about to kill her off. She can't do interviews next week, so we got to get her to do them this week. You know, that kind of thing.
Rob, let me ask you a question. If you were in a neighborhood at Christmas time, and everyone,
I'm sorry, I know where it's going.
And everyone in the neighborhood on your street, okay, on your street is putting up white Christmas lights. Do you feel that you should put up white Christmas lights if they ask you nicely?
They invite you to join them in the white out of the neighborhood.
If they had a cause and they bought the lights for me,
what do you
maybe.
Mean a cause? What's a cause?
If they said, we're doing this to eradicate.
Okay, no, no.
This
oh,
is just,
don't give them that idea because they'll
just,
come up with that.
This is just for uniformity. This is,
no, 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 absolutely not. Absolutely not.
You would not? You would not?
No.
Wow. Interesting.
Big D had 3 years ago had a neighbor who had invited him, hey, we're all doing white lights. You have colored lights. You should go with white lights with us. And Big D's like, no, no, thank you. 2 days later, he comes home and all the lights on his house had been changed out from the colored lights to the white lights. And his colored lights were put in a bag and put by the garage. And so we went at about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, camoed up, face paint, you name it. And we went out and did a little little rogue run on his neighbor's house and took all the white lights down and put up colored lights on the neighbor's house. Because a little tit for tat kind of thing.
I'm in.
And so that was 3 years ago. Nothing has happened ever since. It's
well,
been good.
Well, no, 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 no. Again, you live distant from my
but
reality.
Saying, but I'm saying nobody.
I had to see that guy every other day.
But were you approached?
And I did. He and I talked. I had to go talk to him after the fact. It was a big thing, man. Mm. I mean, he had his lights
zip tied
around the tree
yeah.
to make him really, because he's. Super
unlike his neighbor, where you know he put Big D's stuff neatly in a bag, I had to cut his off. So
cut the wires. Yeah. So I had to go talk to him, and I'm like, hey, you know, Merry Christmas. I know this got out of hand, and you know we. And I said,
what's
hey,
the last
started,
2 years been like? Have you just been laying
been,
low
it's like,
in the
it's
light
like,
wars?
It's like this. It's like. It's like we dated, and now we're both married to someone else, and we see each other, and we kind of go, hello, hi. It's just weird. It's like an ex. It's odd.
It's like roaming the halls of your high school after you break up with
someone. You made a decision?
So this guy comes back to him and says, hey, you know, let's go ahead and do this light thing again. We're going to all be unified. You should do it totally. And then did hashtag WLM, white lights matter. And then put LOL at the end. Ha, 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 ha.
Ha, 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 ha.
So I'm like, uh-uh.
Nope.
ALM, baby.
All lights matter.
That's right. Put up the colored lights.
Yeah, I'm talking to real estate agents at this point.
Really?
That's too non-confrontational there, Rob. You need to be more, you know. I'm buying new colored lights. Mm-hmm. I'm not just using the ones I already had.
Or Christmas fireworks. Hey, we're doing fireworks this year. You want to join us?
Oh,
I like that,
man. I don't know. I've got to make a decision. We're announcing whatever the decision is I make on Monday's show. But
we're giving him a couple days to sleep on this.
I've got
to giving him a couple of days to talk to his wife and make sure he doesn't start.
Well, the thing is, man. We're exactly right. I have to live there, and so I don't want to be. You know, and listen, they're all having white lights. What? Is it killing me just to put up white lights and have a unified thing?
Can you do me a favor and just kind of
what's next though?
Scout his house out and see if he's got cameras or anything you might see.
I'm telling you,
we could do it again.
No, we're not. We're all doing that.
I like the idea of everyone having white lights and you having the one house with colored lights.
It makes you stand out. It makes you special.
We're all making rabbit casseroles.
What
does that even mean, Rob?
That's next.
Oh, yeah.
You got to worry about what's coming next. Yeah. After you succumb to the lights, there's going to be a second one.
Everybody's doing it.
It's Stepford. It's Stepford.
Join us.
Oh, I never watched it. I just can't believe that it's even a thing after what happened. Like after,
that's why he tried to make a joke.
I mean, he really
out of it.
Drew a line in the sand with taking down his lights. The fact that you got approached again is like,
well,
man.
He wrote me a note.
I know, but it's still.
Was it handwritten or was it done like on the printer?
It was handwritten. And he also put, I know we have history with lights. And the history, he capitalized H-I-S, history. I'm like, what does that even, what?
That's the Michael Jackson album.
Like, seriously, that's the title of Michael Jackson's
anthology.
Or he wanted to make sure the wives didn't get involved.
Oh,
right?
So.
You know, so yeah. Let's keep this between the men's.
His wife.
I don't know.
His wife.
Because why would you do it?
So you're promoting
you're
that
Big
D. That.
You know,
Big D
you're
should
saying
take
that
a stand.
For everyone to hear, right?
Okay. What?
I wasn't even listening.
That his wife's kooky. His wife's kooky.
Okay.
Yeah, I said it for everyone to hear.
I like cookies.
She is a complete whack.
So, Rob, who's the most interesting person you've ever interviewed?
I mean,
she has to be married to that maniacal guy.
Oh, God.
But at the same time, do I want to have this whole...
You know, they look at Kathy and they go, poor thing. I'm sure.
And by the way, happy belated anniversary here on the thing. We never said anything about it on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Man,
you know why we didn't say anything about it on the show?
Why?
$10 says D doesn't know until after the show it was his anniversary.
Well, I did I saw his dinner evening Instagram thing. Hey, you know, we're married. Yay. It's our anniversary.
We're married.
So I went ahead and I shared that everywhere. So
it was a great picture, too.
It was.
I don't understand. You know, listen, after 21 years, you kind of go, I was telling Kathy on the way home because we took the boys with us. We have two sons because we wanted them to be with us because, you know, they're the huge. I mean, that's the best thing we did is them. And so we wanted them there just to hang out, and they didn't want to be there really. But I said, man, I could have gone to Las Palmas and been just as happy.
Like just find a little.
It was. We went to Roots Chris, and it was great. $471.
Oh my God!
I'm like, what?
I'd have gone to Taco Bell.
Why are we doing that? I go, what's the point? I mean, it was great. It's good.
But I always have this weird thing about expensive meals. I know this is dumb and it's going to really tick off a lot of people, but you're just paying for poop. That's okay. All you're doing. But it's
true. You're paying for the experience. You're paying for all kinds of stuff.
No, you're paying for poop. That's very expensive
poop. Well, then you're
poop.
Not the target audience of that. So just don't ruin it for everyone else. Jeez.
Do you guys have any poop specials tonight? We do. T-bone poop that you can get.
Rob, do you regret being here now?
The tomahawk sirloin poop I recommend.
Is that a thing, the tomahawk sirloin?
Oh, the tomahawk. Tomahawk steaks.
What is that?
Great.
Tomahawk steak was on the menu. It's $120.
Ew.
They're awesome. They're awesome looking because everybody always takes the picture. It's like you're holding it or whatever.
So it's got the big...
No, I'm on that. Hold on.
It's got the meat on the end.
Just Google tomahawk steak.
And then you have the bone that's attached to it that comes way out, and they shave it down. Most places do. And to where it looks like...
Like a handle.
It's like a handle. It's like a tomahawk.
Oh, that's a bone-in ribeye, isn't it?
No, it's
or
a tomahawk.
Cowboy ribeye?
I don't know.
Can you hold it up, Patrick? I don't have my phone with me.
It's a steak with
it's one of those,
still,
yeah. It's very Flintstones.
It very, very Flintstone-y.
Well, you can't eat it with your shoes on.
Oh, well.
What?
It's like Flintstones.
They didn't wear shoes.
They didn't wear shoes at Flintstones.
I got it. Yeah, okay.
By the way, one of the worst movies ever is the Flintstone live action movie.
The first one or Viva
That'll make
Rock
you
want to
go drink again.
I had planned on missing
Yeah, they did
that
Viva yeah. Rock Vegas.
It's awful. Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Like, I'd make that up.
Any songs that you're working on that we can promote or that...
No, nothing like that. The things that I've got independent stuff going on. Michael Spriggs, who I met doing the Trace Adkins Christmas tour, has a Christmas album out. I've got a song I wrote with him on that. And... writing with Aleph McCormick, who works with the Chieftains and stuff. So it's all independent stuff.
Okay.
But thanks for the thought.
Yeah, all right. Well, if you ever want to get together and write, Patrick, he writes. He loves to get together with people to write.
I don't know how good I am sober, but we'll.
Five Whiskey Patrick, I should say.
Yeah.
Get together with Five Whiskey Patrick. And then
glad that came up finally. How long has that been sitting in?
I honestly
didn't even know it was a thing.
I didn't even know. I did not. It was nice. It's nice to meet you.
I'm gonna regret that at some point.
Of course, on the countdown. Is your voice on it or just the clip? It's just the behind the scenes.
Yep.
Yeah. So you'll hear if you hear any interviews on Kingsley's countdowns on the weekends. You'll know that it was
Rob that asked those
you'll be
questions.
Like, wow, that's a really a thoughtful question. Oh, really well thought out. Kingsley is super. No. That's Rob. Rob's doing that. Okay.
Yeah, get me in trouble. That's all I need.
You're going to ruin his job.
His voice is so ridiculous.
Isn't it?
It's so. I'm like.
And it's the same voice he orders spaghetti with.
And the thing is, here's what I like about his voice. His voice is not. It's not perfect. It's got a texture to it.
Like mine?
Yeah, yours is more like. cuts glass.
I was kidding. I was making a joke.
But his voice is, it's kind of that
impression is not flattering.
But it moves so well.
It's like butter.
It's, I don't know, it's really good.
He speaks like Astaire dances.
He what?
He speaks like Fred Astaire dances.
Oh, yes.
I thought exactly you meant like a set of stairs.
Yeah, no, that's what I heard.
Sorry.
I was like, Fred Astaire dances?
Yeah. I thought he said a steer. Yeah. I was like, wait, what?
That's a great example of know your audience.
We're like, Fred Astaire references? Not going to work in the Big D and Bubba studio. Not very well.
You have to use like...
okay, everybody, stop. It's soft shoe time.
Saved by the Bell analogies. Those are great. Yeah, use those all day.
Fresh print.
All
a little bit
day
of Futurama.
Long.
Star Wars. We're down.
Yeah, we're down. It's good to see you, man. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you very much.
And all the stories. Man, that's super cool about your not drinking and doing the marathons. And it's pretty cool.
It's
pretty cool.
I've enjoyed it.
It's really neat. All right,
glad
so
you're still here.
Yeah, coming up after now is the interview we did with Dean Dillon. Dean Dillon, maybe one of the greats.
If you'd like to hear Patrick freak out and totally fangirl over a songwriter,
he comes in, he's like, okay, like he's preparing. It's like you know, you're meeting the parents for the first time. Okay, he's almost here. Okay, guys, now listen. Steen Dillon, okay? Everyone settle down.
I just want y'all to be cool. Every now and then y'all are not cool. Bubba said poop 4 times earlier. I'm like, please don't do that.
What's wrong with that?
I don't know.
It's real life.
Do you poop, don't you?
Stop!
I think we all poop.
No,
I think there's a book about that.
Kim Jong-un does not.
I'm from Connecticut. We don't.
I was about to say, yeah, Kim Jong-un does not poop, as it turns out.
Yeah, that's what
that's why he keeps
Carson has in common with
there.
Anyway, okay, so we'll play it for you. That is on the way next. And
for those of you watching on Facebook, you need to actually listen to and download the podcast and all that.
Yep.
So go to your podcast app, whether it's on Google Play or Apple Podcast or whatever you're using. Find it that way because it's really, really worth hearing. I mean, this is a guy who's written songs for everyone, from Waylon to obviously most well known for George Strait, but Kenny Chesney and so many others. You're going to love hearing his stories.
Yep. Rob, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed being here.
Y'all ready to close it out?
Yep. Do you need to say who it's brought by?
Oh, yeah. The podcast, see, this is the thing. A lot of things can go wrong in 20 minutes, like, you know, saying poop or something like that. Your car's engine is no different. Up to 75% of engine wear actually happens during warm-up, but Castrol GTX Magnetech has intelligent molecules that cling to your engine like a magnet. It provides you instant protection from the moment you start. Thank you again, Rob.
Thank you.
This was the podcast, but now it's over. But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio every day. It was the podcast.
Hey, our songwriter spotlight is really special today. Maybe the best songwriter ever.
Wait! What, you mumbled that a little bit.
I mean, I don't know. I think it's he's maybe the best songwriter ever.
This is the most excited and the most nervous I've ever been to do.
Really?
Songwriter spotlight. Yes.
Patrick has been working really hard to get Dean Dillon into the studio for a long, long time. I mean,
I emailed your wife, Miss Susie, about a dozen times trying to just hammer down a date when we'd all be in the same place at the same time. So I'm really feeling good that we finally set this up.
Man, it's an honor to be here with you boys this morning. I've just been, seems like the last 2 years on the road. I've been home maybe a month, my ranch. But it's a great big, wild, wonderful world out there, and I sure have seen a lot of it.
You know, you're probably most associated with George Strait. When was the first time you met George?
It was actually after we'd had two or three number one records together.
You had two or three number one records together before you met him?
Before I met him, yeah.
What?
Yeah, we were both on different record labels, and our paths never crossed, you know. We were always, one was going one way and one was going the other. And then Irv, his manager, Irv Woolsey, called me up and said, "Hey, man, you want to meet George?" And I'm like, "Well, duh." Yeah.
Sure.
I walked in there chain smoking Marlboro Reds. You know, you could do that back in those days. And I sat down, here's this good-looking kid from Texas, man. first words out of his mouth were, "Hey, man, you mind putting that cigarette out? Smoke bothers me." And I took a big old drag off that Marlboro and said, "You mean this?" And then we laughed, and everything was rosy after that.
And then, like, you've been on, there's been a song of yours on basically every album of George's ever since?
Yeah, except with the exception of the soundtrack for the movie.
When you go through the catalog of George Strait hits, I mean, and there's other artists, obviously, we're going to talk about, but just George Strait alone, Easy Come, Easy Go, Famous Last Words of a Fool, If I Know Me, Living for the Night, Marina Del Rey, Nobody in His Right Mind, Oceanfront Property, She Let Herself Go, The Best Day, The Breath You Take, The Chair, Unwound.
Wait, stop. How do you write The Chair?
You know, in 1980, I hooked up with Hank Cochran. And he became my mentor, my father figure, my songwriting partner in crime. And we moved basically to the Bahamas on his boat. And we lived there for several years.
That sounds terrible.
Several years?
We took a trip down to Miami. And we get down there, and the first day we're there, we write Miami, Miami. We'd been celebrating hard, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. He's sitting there on the boat in a chair, and I looked at him, picked up a guitar, said, "Well, excuse me, but I think you've got my chair." And he goes, "Have you written that?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, we're going to right now." And this is at 4 o'clock in the morning, and both of us are just worn out, you know. But the song came relatively quickly. The first verse just poured out on paper, and then we got stuck. Well, Hank, whenever we'd get stuck on a line or a verse or whatever, Hank would get up and walk around that boat and come back in and say something brilliant, you know. And he came back in that time and he goes, "How about this? Well, thank you. Can I drink you a buy? I'll listen to me. What I mean is, can I buy you a drink, anything you please?" And I thought, my word, man. I thought two things, actually. I thought, well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of, or this man's brilliant, and I think I'll go with brilliant.
And it seems to have worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it did.
That is unbelievable. I mean, the stories of songs, country music is, it's why we do the whole
songwriter spotlight.
It's because hearing stories like that, of knowing that that song came from that. Mm-hmm. So now every time we all hear it, we are on a boat.
Right.
Instead of George Strait walking up to a pretty girl in a bar, I'm going to see you walking up to a country dude music on a Hall boat. Of Famer on a boat and asking, telling him he's in your chair. Well, you may have ruined the song, actually.
Yeah, actually,
now that I think of it.
You know, make up different stories for it. Our songwriter spotlight, the one and only Dean Dillon, will come back, talk more with him next. Hey, our songwriter spotlight, Dean Dillon is joining us. He has written... a couple of songs.
You just might as well say just about everything.
He's written pretty much everything.
You know all your favorite songs? He wrote them.
Yeah, he did. What is your song that you get? You probably get the most recognition for? People go, "Man, I love that one. You did that one?"
These days, it's Tennessee Whiskey.
You wrote it a while back.
Yeah, 1980. Linda Hargrove. I'd heard about this girl songwriter, and I... tell you how naive I was. I didn't even know girls wrote songs back then. So I go to the Bluebird Cafe to catch her show. She's playing at the Bluebird, and I walk in, sit down, watch her set, and walk up to her after her set's over and introduce myself. And, you know, I'd had this idea, that this chorus for a while, and I'd told Linda about it. And again, at 4 o'clock in the morning, we went over to her place and wrote that song, and then... right off the bat, first person I pitch it to is Strait. You know, anything I thought was any good, I always gave him first shot at it. Funny, he turned it down, and we laugh about it today, but that's probably why the only reason I have cuts on other artists is because he cut them, he turned them down, you know. But George cut it, and the song climbs to 2.
You're talking about George Jones.
George Jones.
Yeah.
And the song climbs to 2 and stays there for 6 weeks at number 2.
Do you remember what was in front of it?
Yeah.
For 6 weeks?
If I said you had a beautiful body, would you hold it against me? Which stayed number 1 for like 2.5 years. And finally, after about 6 weeks, we snuck in at number 1 in Cashbox or something. I can't remember. And so I'm walking down the alley over on the road one day, and out the back door of the studio walks Billy Sherrill, who is George Jones' producer. He said, Dylan, he said, man, if you'd have wrote that song a little better, we'd have had number one record. And I said, well, you know what? If you could produce worth a hoot. And here I am telling this to a guy who's, you know, who's yeah. produced everything under the sun.
Loving her today,
right, up know, to that yeah. point, yeah. And we had a good laugh. But and then later on, a couple of years go by, and then an old running buddy of mine, David Allen Coe, called me up, said, hey, man, come up to the house. I'm going to play you your song. So I go up to David's house.
Is the air conditioning on?
It was, thank okay. God. So anyway, we sit there on the couch, and he's got this sound system in front of us, and it's cranked wide open, and he's playing the whole album. And his little boy's like 3 years old, maybe. And this little kid's, you know, doing airplanes through the house. You know mm-hmm. how little kids do. And the 15th time he comes by, David trips him, and he splatters against the wall.
Wow.
And okay. he looks at that little kid, and he said, shut up, damn it. Daddy's digging on himself. And I lost it.
Daddy's digging on himself is great.
Daddy's digging on himself.
What was it like? When did you first hear Chris Stapleton do that song? Because I know I had seen him do it in concert a few times before he recorded it.
Ronnie Bowman called me up and said, man, listen to this, and put the phone, I guess, to a speaker in the studio or something. And when I heard Stapleton's R&B version of Tennessee Whiskey, it just dropped me to my knees, man. It was just amazing.
You know, you could totally make our day if we could hear your version of Tennessee Whiskey.
I used to spend my nights out in a bar room. Liquor was the only love I'd known. But you rescued me from reaching for the bottom. Brought me back from being too far gone. You're as smooth as Tennessee whiskey. You're as sweet as strawberry wine. You're as warm as a glass of brandy. Honey, I stay strong on your love. I stay strong on your love. Oh. The time. How about that?
Now, was the song wasn't a waltz?
No.
So now you just did it right there. You as a waltz. Have you kind of adopted that? Maybe that's the way it should have been all along.
Well, that's kind of my take on it. You
yeah,
know?
That's that was amazing.
I feel like we can just retire now, huh?
I mean. I could sit here and ask questions all day. So,
well, I don't think Dean has anything to do. I mean, he said.
Fire at will.
I have nothing to do. All right, Dean Dillon is our guest, our songwriter spotlight. We'll talk more with him. And also the Dean Dillon story. It's pretty sweet to film, and we'll talk about that more, too, next. Hey, our songwriter spotlight, and Dean Dillon is joining us in the studio. He has written, you know, George Strait hits and David Allen Coe and
Keith Whitley Kenny Chesney, Toby Keith, yeah, Vern Gosden. Dude, yeah. Set him up, Joe. Dude. I mean, come on.
What a jam. Also, hey, you have a there is a film documentary on you. It's called Tennessee Whiskey, the Dean Dillon Story. I've seen the trailer. I haven't seen the film. The trailer is super cool. That's a head rush, man. When you've got all these stars who are talking about how awesome you are, you've made a lot of cool friends over the years.
Man, I've just been blessed, you know, been real lucky to be in the right place at the right time a few times. And
didn't you write that? Oh, that's Nobody in Drama. That's close.
Nobody in Drama. You know, it's like the thing was straight. You know, he was a totally unknown artist. And I remember sitting on the porch with Frank Dykus, and we had written Unwound that day. And a guy named Blake Meavis comes flying down the street in his car, pulls up to the curb, rolls his window down, and says, "Hey, man, I got this kid from Texas I'm fixing to record, and I need some songs." And in those days, you didn't give your top drawer stuff, your best songs, to an unknown artist. You just didn't do that. You wanted to cut on Cash or Haggard or Dolly or Loretta, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember thinking, I don't have much going right now, and I'd do anything for a cut, really. It wasn't as much about George as it was trying to get a song cut. Man, I'm glad that we made that decision. I told Blake when we were sitting on the porch, I said, you know, we were going to pitch this song to Paycheck, but he's in jail. So I guess you can have the song.
And then it turned into Unwound, like the Unwound that we all know now.
Right.
And imagine if Paycheck hadn't been in jail.
Man, yeah.
I mean,
there might not be a George Strait.
The whole world would spin differently.
Yeah, that's crazy when you think about it.
But the other crazy thing about all of that is, Dykus and I wound up with half that album because nobody would give him anything.
Wow. Well, nobody would give George Strait.
No.
Because he was unknown.
Yeah, unknown. Nobody wanted to pitch him anything, and we threw everything but the kitchen sink at him.
And it seems to have paid off.
But the great thing about it was, show you what kind of guy he is. The next time it came album time, I get a phone call from him. "Where are you? Meet me at my office at 10 o'clock Monday morning. I want to hear some your songs." By virtue of having, you know, went out on a limb on that first album with him, you know, he never forgot it.
It's like an investment. You know, got in early, and it paid off forever.
And in the deal with Kenny Chesney, we were both writing for Acuff Rose. He had actually been at Acuff Rose for a couple years, and Troy Tomlinson called me up one day. He said, "Man, would you write with Kenny Chesney?" And I said, "Sure I will, man. He's an old East Tennessee boy, and that's where I'm from, you know." He said, "Well, he's been dying to write with you, man." But I told him, you know, he's got to get up to your level. And I kind of laughed that off. And so a couple days later, Kenny Chesney walks in my office at Acuff Rose, and I've got my back turned to him. I'm looking out the window, and he comes in, and he's jacked to the ceiling, man. He is so excited. And he said, "Man, I know we're just going to write something great today." And I turned around, and I looked at him. I said, and I did this big old yawn. I'm like, "Kenny, give me a minute to get down to your level." And he looked at me, and his jaw dropped, and I busted out laughing. And then he busted out laughing. And we broke the ice and have been friends ever since, and have written quite an – we've got a pretty extensive catalog together. We probably got maybe 35 songs together we've written.
Wow.
I love the Islands.
He owns like four of them.
Well, yeah, that and or used to. It all got blown away with Maria, the hurricane this time around, but which is sad. We were just over there about a month before that, my wife and I and Phil Marie, and we'd taken a sailboat over there and before it all got blown away. And it got blown away.
Bad.
There were 30 people in Kenny's house out trying to get out of that storm, and it blew the windows out of the house first. So they all run downstairs in a closet, and that hurricane proceeded to just destroy the house, just piece by piece, just blow it away.
Wow.
And I talked to him last night, man, and he said, there's nothing left over there. It's really a sad
thing. He's doing so much work behind the scenes.
He's single-handedly. He's like a one-man army trying
to get
people
in. Yeah, he's flying plane over there every day carrying medical supplies, you know, dog food, whatever that they need to get over there, man. It's just the forces of nature, you know, did not smile on them that day. And that was our old stomping ground. You know, we hung out at Foxy's. We wrote a lot of songs. He and I and Scotty Emmerich wrote a lot of songs over there in those islands and at his house and on a boat and whatever, you know, and it's all gone now.
I have to ask something. This is probably just for me. We have a list of all these great songs that you've written, and we could ask about all of them. But I'm going to ask about one that was a hit, but maybe not as big as some of the others. I never got to see Gary Stewart. I don't remember him from when I was a kid. You know, it was something I came to late, and I realized that people who are musicians and songwriters, and every country artist I've ever talked to about this, Gary Stewart's one of these guys that everybody loves. Mm-hmm. He's like one of these musicians that all musicians respect and all songwriters respect. Maybe my favorite country song of all time you wrote with Gary Stewart was called An Empty Glass. Mm-hmm. And since I'll never get to see Gary Stewart play it, I was wondering if you might be able to give us a little bit of that, if it's even something you have in your head.
Sure. You know, Jerry Bradley, who was the head of RCA at the time, Gary and I both recorded for that label. And Jerry got the bright idea to pair us up and put us together, actually to go after the Mo and Joe spot, you know.
Maybe get nominated for some CMAs.
Stuff like that. And so he pairs us up. Well, that was like pouring gasoline on gasoline, man. I mean, it was pretty crazy. But I remember the first tour we did together and walking on stage with him. He plugged that Stratocaster in, and I had never seen anything like that in my life. But Gary was crazy in an insanely good way, man. That guy was the best pure honky-tonk singer that I'd ever heard in my life. And to this day, I still say that it's like Toby Keith said, he's kind of a cross between Jerry Lee Lewis and this wild man. You know, but when he walked on stage with that Strat and plugged it in, boys, the game was on. We went to his house to write this album, and we wound up writing like 13 songs in 3 days. One of the songs was An Empty Glass, Last Cigarette, It's Closing Time, I'm Drunk Again, but somehow I'll make it home, cry myself to sleep, that's the way the day ends, every night for me. Every night I'm in some bar, pouring whiskey on a heart that's on fire. Forgetting you is no easy thing. Each night for me always ends the same, with an empty glass, last cigarette, It's Closing Time, I'm Drunk Again, but somehow I'll make it home, cry myself to sleep, oh, that's the way the day ends, every night for me. With an empty glass.
Wow.
Patrick's face is like,
oh my God,
like a little kid on Christmas morning.
I never get to say this to someone on this level. I have a group of friends that all love sad country songs, and we have once a month we get together at a bar and we put $40 in the jukebox and we have three rules. You have to play songs about drinking or your woman leaving or drinking because she left. And that song usually comes up like three or four times because there's different versions of it out there.
Yeah.
And it's one of the best sad country songs of all time. And I probably could have asked you to play The Chair or Set 'Em Up Joe. Yeah, I picked something a little bit more obscure.
Man, I'm glad you did. You know, that song, it's funny. It's taken on its own life down in Texas. If you walk in any bar, just about the last song of the night that they play is Empty Glass. Mm-hmm. It's kind of...
It's the closing time song.
It is.
Because of Gary, it's legendary down there, you know. And, as he was. You know, I don't think people really give him the credit that he deserved.
If he lived another 20 years, he'd be in the Country Music Hall of Fame right now.
He was a rarity, guys. You got to understand, this guy was all of 5'6", you know, skinny as a rail. And like I said, when he plugged that Stratocaster in, man, it was game on. I've told people before, I live, eat, and sleep and breathe songs. Well, he lived, eat, slept, and breathed guitars and singing. That guy, and Wayne Carson was writing all these great songs for him, you know. Man, the guy could go. He could go.
Thank you so much. It's been such an awesome songwriter spotlight.
I think we need to give out the info about the documentary, too, one more time. Yeah. Because this is, I mean, we're just barely scratching the surface. And if you go and check out the documentary, it's available on Amazon. It's on iTunes. It's all over the place, right?
Right.
Yeah, just go to Google and search for it.
Tennessee Whiskey, the Dean Dillon story is the name of it, and check it out. And Dean, again, thank you so much for the decades of great songs and for continuing to write these amazing hits, and we appreciate it, and for your time, and wish you the best, brother.
Hey, man, you know what? Thank you guys for doing what you do. You're doing something important here, and I think it's important to look into and have on your show these guys and girls that write these songs. You know, everybody always hears about the artists, but they don't know very much about the songwriters. And I personally just want to thank you all for having me on the show, and it's a pleasure to play Empty Glass for you.
Thank you so much.
Dean Dillon, everyone.